Welcome to the Trinity's Podcast, where we explore theories about the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
Episode 34, Part 2 of my debate with Roman Catholic apologist William Albrecht. The topic is, was Tertullian a Trinitarian? The second part starts with our cross-examinations of one another, and then it ends with our closing statements. I've edited this debate for length to respect your time, and I haven't included the questions and answers from people who called into the show. You can hear those if you listen to the last part of the original broadcast, and the link for that is on the blog post for this episode. I've edited out the transitions, but it's pretty clear when we switch sides. So without further ado, here's part two of the debate.
All right, Dr. Tuggy, in Against Praxeas 27, when we're told that the Word is eternal, in this passage, I would assume that you believe that Tertullian is referencing the Son's matter only, how the Word became flesh, whether it was by having been transfigured, as it were, in the flesh, or by having really clothed himself in the flesh. Certainly it was by a real clothing of himself, for the rest must needs believe God to be unchangeable and incapable of form as being eternal. Is this referring simply to, I don't know, some sort of quasi-matter or some matter in Tertullian's terminology?
I see what passage you're talking about. How the Word came flesh as having been changed to the form of flesh or having put on flesh as a covering must be believed that God is unchangeable and incapable of outward form as being everlasting. So I take it God there is referring to the Father. And he says the Word is, lower down, he says the Word is God and the Word of the Lord abideth forever.
So when Tertullian here references the Word in the Latin and he continues going, you believe that the Word became flesh as the Father? Am I correct? Because he's talking about the Word here. He's talking about the Word here, the Word that was transfigured. He then tells us that God needs to be believed that God is unchangeable and capable of form as being eternal. In this passage, which he is speaking about the Word, are you asserting that the Word in this passage is the Father?
No, I'm not a monarchian.
Okay, so you do not believe that Tertullian is, when he says how the Word became flesh, and he goes on about talking about the transfiguration of the Son, you believe he's speaking about the Father here, or do you believe that he then changes his mindset and then he says that God, he's referring to God the Father?
No, he believes in, a pre-existent logos, which existed since just before creation, and then he thinks that this logos was sent down and went into Mary, basically. He doesn't have quite as worked out a Christology as later people, but I'm not quite sure what you're driving at.
My question to you is, who is the logos in Tertullian theology?
He thinks the logos is personally identical to the Son, just as in later Catholic theory.
Okay, so the logos in this passage would be the Son. Am I correct? That's the only question I'm trying to get from you. Is the Word, is the logos here the Son? Is that who he's referring to?
Well, so like the term God, the term logos is equivocal. It can refer to God's reason, which of course has to be eternal because God is eternally rational. So it can mean either one. It just depends on the sentence, right?
Correct. My question to you is, where in this passage?
But one's merely an attribute, and one is basically a god, that is an intelligent being made of divine matter. If that's what a god is, then the logos is a god, but not the one true god.
Where does he use the term a god in the Latin?
Actually. This is a tricky point about the Latin, because Latin doesn't have the definite article. So it's not like Greek, where they can distinguish between theos and hotheos. So when it just says deus, it can be translated as the God, and it can also be translated as a God. And, you know, the translator usually picks the first, which may or may not be correct, but you see this ambiguity in all these ancient Latin authors.
Okay.
Kind of unfortunate.
Don't you think it'd be a little bit odd that Tertullian would be talking about a God being unchangeable, incapable of form, and being eternal? I mean, regardless of there being a term in the Latin for a God, is he just referring to a sort of God, and this sort of God is unchangeable, incapable of form, and eternal? Isn't that a kind of peculiar sort of a God Or is that...
Well, again, we look at the context, right? So when he uses the word God, sometimes it's very clear that he has in mind the Father. For instance, at the start of all of his rules of faith, all the rules of faith he mentions start off with a confession in one God, and it's clearly meeting the Father, and then it switches to talking about the Word and the Son. Yeah, it just depends. I mean, both the term logos and the term God are equivocal. You read it however best makes sense of the passage. But the important point to see, and this is a point that he makes explicitly in a passage maybe we'll talk about, is that beings other than the one true God can be called God. Okay, so William, how do you define the term Trinitarian for the purpose of this debate?
How do I define the term Trinity? I define the term Trinity the exact same way that the Catholic Church defines the term Trinity. And let me answer that really quickly. I'm not going to go through the whole opening statement that I had, but...
Okay, no, that's good enough. I think we know what the Catholic Church says. That's good enough. So look, he's not going to be, in your view, a Trinitarian on multiple counts.
Sorry? If you don't mind, I'll finish my sentence really quickly. My view is, in God, there are three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, and each of the three persons possesses the one numerical divine essence. I understand you understand Catholic theology. I just wanted to get that out there.
Sure. So Tertullian doesn't think that there are three persons in one God. What he thinks is there's one batch of matter that's shared by three divine persons, one of whom is the one true God. Are you taking the line that Christians believed in the Trinity from the beginning as defined by the Council of Constantinople and later councils?
It depends what you mean by that. Do I believe that the Church has always believed in the Holy Trinity? Absolutely, definitely.
The Church has always believed in a triune God of co-equal divine persons.
The Church has always, from the very beginning, the New Testament scriptures teach the Trinity explicitly. The Old Testament teaches the Trinity as well. I believe that the Trinity is a divine reality. It's always existed. It didn't just pop up in time at a later period.
Right. Okay, so you're taking a very strong view. I mean, I think you should stick with the more honest Roman Catholic scholars who admit that the Trinity totally is not taught in the Old Testament or in the New Testament, but developed later.
Let me just make one point. Cross-examination is for questions, and you're there giving me an opinion on what I should stick to. I'm a Catholic. I stick to the traditional Catholic faith. If you believe in modern Catholic theology, that's your thing. I believe in Catholic theology as it has been traditionally taught, as it is dogmatized, and as it is framed in the teachings of the Church. I'm not a modernist. I am a Catholic, and I believe the faith 100%.
Right, but this is the Catholic strategy. You say something different and new, and then you say this is what we've always taught. I'm just trying to bring that out.
Well, I guess we can debate that another day, though. Today we're debating Napoleon.
Okay, here's a question for you. Do you agree that the doctrine of divine simplicity is part of the official Roman Catholic doctrine of the Trinity?
It depends how you would define that. You define a number of terms differently, so if you want to go ahead and define that.
Yeah, we'll define it as in the Fourth Lateran Council, Constitution 1. There's one true God, et cetera, incomprehensible, ineffable, one absolutely simple essence.
Do you agree with that? I mean, absolute simplicity is pretty clear what that means in ancient philosophy and theology. No parts, no components, no distinctions, right? But if you believe in a material God...
I believe in every single ecumenical council.
Right. So then you agree that the dogma of the Trinity includes divine simplicity.
If it's taught by an ecumenical council of the Catholic Church, I believe it. I believe the ecumenical council to be infallible.
Do you believe that a being which is composed of a portion of matter is a simple being?
Does the Fourth Council of Lateran say that?
I mean, this is just part of the general understanding of simplicity that goes back to Platonic philosophy.
Again, I just want to confirm with you that if it is said in a Catholic council, an ecumenical council, I believe it to be infallible. If you want to go ahead and ask me what I believe, what you can go ahead and do, let me just finish. What would be a little bit better for you would be to quote a canon. There are around 69, close to 70 canons in the Fourth Council of Lateran. You can quote them to me, and you can ask me if I believe it. If it's a canon, you're quoting verbatim. You can know already.
Right, but you need to answer the question rather than just tell me about your commitments. Do you agree that a being composed of matter is not a simple being?
What canon is that taught in? Can you quote that? Can you read it out loud and tell me what canon that's taught?
I'm not asking you if it's taught. I'm just asking you if you agree with this, because really by the definition of simplicity,
a simple being cannot be composed of matter, because there'd be a distinction between form and matter in that being. That's just what simplicity means. Okay, so if you're committed to simplicity being part of the Trinity, you don't think Tertullian is a Trinitarian.
Oh, I definitely do believe that Tertullian is a Trinitarian, but you're bringing up the Fourth Council Latin.
Oh, yeah. Who needs consistency?
Okay, you're cross-examining me. If you're going to be making little snide remarks like that, I can make snide remarks and so well when I cross-examine you. If you're going to bring up the Fourth Council of Latin...
Gentlemen, I just want to ask that we try to be respectable, and in a cross-exam, we address one another by questions, and so...
Yes.
You know, let's make sure that...
Right. We also do need to answer the questions.
Yeah, let's try to make sure we stick to the subject. It's Tertullian and Trinitarian.
Yeah, try to answer.
And
the Fourth Council of Lateran is not part of the debate. Very, very good point there, Gus. The Fourth Council of Lateran is not part of the debate. So, yeah, let's stick to answering the questions that pertain to the debate. Now, going back to Tertullian, I want to go right back to where we left off a little while ago. That's all right with you. Right back to against Praxias 27, because I know these six-minute cross-exams, they can go so fast. So I just want to lay the groundwork and just be certain we're on the same page here. The word in this passage, is the word referencing the Logos, Christ, Dr. Dale Tuggy?
Well, yeah, it can be. I mean, again, you're not telling me a really specific sentence or paragraph, so sure, it can be, and it can also be God's eternal wisdom. Basically, God's rationality.
Is this passage here referencing the Logos, the Word? Is this Christ being referred to here?
William, I'm looking at like three screens full of words here. Go ahead and read me the sentence, and I'll find it.
Sure. Let me go ahead and read it to you directly. How the Word became flesh. Again, you can do a simple search. You pull it up. Whether it was by having been transfigured, as it were, in the flesh, or by having really clothed himself in the flesh. Certainly it was by a real clothing of himself in the in flesh. For the rest, we must need believe God to be unchangeable and incapable of form as being eternal. Is this in reference to Christ, the Logos, or am I misreading this passage?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, it is, or am I misreading it? Which one?
The Word is God, yeah. Uh-huh.
It is a reference to Christ. Okay.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. I just want to be certain. I want to be on the same wavelength with you. You do agree this is a reference to Christ, right?
Yeah, I think so. But, of course, incarnation isn't the issue between us. I agree that, in a sense, he believes in incarnation.
No, incarnation is not in dispute. My question is this passage here referring to Christ? You say that it is. The Word is the Logos. The Logos is Christ. Am I correct?
Sure.
Okay. In the very following sentence, does Tertullian change his mindset and then say, oh, well, for the rest, we must believe that God, the Father, is unchangeable? Is he referring to the Father here as being eternal? Or what is he referring to when he says that God is eternal in this same exact passage after he brings up the Logos, the Word?
For the rest, we must needs believe God to be unchangeable and capable of form. But I don't know what his point is there. Transfiguration is the discretion of that which previously exists. God, whoever another ceases to be what he was, nor can be any other thing than what he is. The Word is God, and the Word of the Lord remains forever, even by holding on unchangeably to its own proper form. So yeah, I mean, the divine matter is special in that way, that it's presumably incapable of destruction, and it's everlasting. And so once he's made of that, then he gains that same status. The Logos, after he's created, right?
Okay, so...
It says created. He makes clear it's at a point in time, too.
Where does it say created? Where is the word created here?
Well, it's in Against Hermogenes more than once, but the same idea is in chapters 6 and 7 that I discussed a bit ago.
I understand that, Dr. Tuggy. Where is the word created here in Against Praxias 27?
I don't see it here.
It's not in Against Praxias 27. The word eternal is here. Who is eternal here? Is the Son eternal? Is he referring to the Father as being eternal? Who is referenced as eternal here?
I take it that he means that the Son is eternal in the sense that we're discussing. Because he's made of that eternal matter, that makes him eternal. That is, once he's made. So he's necessarily everlasting, basically. This doesn't put him outside of time.
where does Tertullian define eternal in the way you're defining it? You're saying that after he's created, he then all of a sudden becomes eternal? How could you be twisting Aladdin in such a way? Does Aladdin allow that?
Well, yeah, I think eternal can, in any language, it can mean everlasting and it can also mean timeless. And I think you're assuming that it means timeless, but it doesn't need to mean that.
After he was created, he became eternal. Is that what the passage says?
We both want to say he's consistent, so you're going to have to understand eternal in a way that's consistent with what he says about Jesus being made at a particular time. He even quotes that psalm, "Today I've become your father," and he seems to understand it temporally.
All right, my time is up, and I believe it's your turn now.
Question, do you think, and please just answer this, do you think it is possible for an attribute to turn into a self, that is, into a living, knowing, acting being, that is, into a person?
For an attribute to turn into a person, what kind of an attribute? What do you mean?
Well, for instance, do you think an omnipotent being could say, take my sense of humor and make my sense of humor into a boy?
I suppose in the sense that could God give something an attribute? Yeah, absolutely. I think that's possible. Yeah.
Yeah, God could create a boy that has the same type of sense of humor as me, right?
Correct. Absolutely. Without a doubt.
That's easy to do, but this is what can't be done. You can't take my individual sense of humor and then make that individual attribute into a being, into a self, right? That's just nonsense, isn't it?
Well, but this is why we're trying to be charitable to Tertullian and understand him. That's why we have to understand him to not be strictly identifying the eternal logos with the Son that come into existence later. Or he does call them both the logos. That's why we have to take him that way.
I missed that, though. He calls both the who does he call both the logos?
Tertullian, sometimes by the logos, he means God's eternal reason. And then sometimes, God's word as eternal, and then he, so to speak, speaks it out. But again, in against Praxeus 6 and 7, that is the creation of the Son in his mind. There's a kind of relation between the Son and the earlier attribute. Now, in our previous cross-examination, we got all uptight because I brought up later Catholic Council. And again, I know I'm not examining you, William. That wasn't my point. My point is, what is the correct Catholic doctrine, right? We can't have it be one thing at one time and another thing at another time. It can't just be that anybody who's in communion with the Catholic Church automatically holds the same thing. That's just not correct. I mean, people change their views.
So, Dr. Tuggy, I just want to go ahead and answer that. Let me just answer that really quickly for you. I understand that you are aware that I believe in Catholic theology, and you made a comment earlier that I think you were leaning on that it was unfortunate that I don't adopt the modern views. Well, I don't adopt modern views. I adopt Orthodox Catholic theology. And in that sense, I will make one statement for you, because I know I have not made it earlier. Maybe you missed it in my opening statement. I'm not arguing that Tertullian is teaching a strict, stringent Nicene type of confession. I never once ever said that. I just want you to be certain there. I don't think Tertullian was completely Orthodox in everything that he said. I just want you to understand that, because you're bringing up council after council, and I think that you think that I think Tertullian was completely Orthodox. I just want to get that out there for you.
Right. So when I say he's Trinitarian, I mean Trinitarian by the Orthodox definition. And, I mean, it sounds like you're conceding that he's definitely not that. So let's move to the other side of the question then. When I say Tertullian's a Unitarian, what I mean is that he identifies the God and Father, and the one God and the Father. When you deny that here's my question. When you deny that he's a Unitarian, what do you mean by Unitarian?
Dr. Tuggy, you made a statement saying that I was conceding that he was not completely that. Let me go ahead and let me make that clear for you. I said that I do not think Tertullian is completely Orthodox on all of his matters, not just in reference to this topic alone. I believe that Tertullian was a Trinitarian. Do I believe he laid out his doctrine in the sense that later councils did? No. I don't believe that. But yes, he was a Trinitarian. I think it was obvious that I laid out 6 points in my opening statement. The Father was eternal, the Son was eternal, the Spirit was eternal were the first three. And I hold to those, and I hold that he taught those.
Right. So my question is, when you deny that he's a Unitarian, what do you mean by Unitarian there? I've explained what I mean by it when I say he is a Unitarian. So if you're using the term Trinitarian so flexibly that a Unitarian can also be one, That's kind of interesting, but I would just like to know what you mean by Unitarian.
I'm not using the term flippantly at all. I don't think Tertullian is a Unitarian in any sense. I think he was a Trinitarian. And in what sense do I mean? Again, once again, let me go ahead and... There are 6 points that I brought up that I think Tertullian taught, and I'm going to name one that I would think he disagreed with me on, and that was on the fact that the Son was eternal God. He teaches in many instances that the Son was eternal God. In that sense, you would not agree with him. In his interpretation of Romans 9:5, you would not agree with him. He interprets that completely different in the manner that a Unitarian would teach it. And I just want to throw one more thing out there. I do not think you're an Arian, Dr. Tuggy. I was making a statement because Arian theology has similarities to Unitarian theology.
Here's another question. You can see that Arians are Unitarians, and you can see that because they identify the one God with the Father, and they think there was a time when the Son did not exist, and the Son is lesser than the Father, okay? I've already shown that Tertullian says all those same things, so why is he not also the Unitarian if the Arians are? What's the difference between him and the Arians?
Because you haven't shown that. All right, Dr. Tuggy, I want to move away from that passage that we were referring to right now. I want to move to Against Praxeus 13:15. I'm going to read it really, really quickly so that you can get a context as you read along. And this is what Tertullian says. But when Christ alone is mentioned, I shall be able to call him God. As the same apostle says, of whom is Christ, who is over all, God blessed forever. Okay, I want to go on, and I want to, since Tertullian here is commenting, he's basically making a commentary on Romans 9:5. Which reads, whose are the fathers, and from whom is the Christ according to the flesh, who is over all, God blessed forever. Amen. My question is, the terms pantom theos, God blessed all over, in Tertullian, to whom is this referring to in Against Praxeus 13:15?
It sounds like the Son.
Okay, great. So Tertullian says that that he can call Christ God, and then he quotes the manuscript of the apostle and says, of whom is Christ, who is overall God blessed forever. So you do agree that he is saying that Christ is God blessed forever here. Am I correct?
Sure, yeah. Unitarians do that.
Oh, okay. So you would translate Romans 9:5, where it says that Christ is God blessed all over. You would translate the term ionos as being anything other than eternal. That's not forever. That's some sort of different type of beginning in Roman theology. I don't understand your...
Well, as you know, that's a controversial verse, and people differ on the translation and the interpretation. I think Paul's referring to God the Father there, but I'm perfectly willing to grant that Tertullian is thinking that God, the one God blessed forever there, is the Son. I'm willing to grant that.
Great, that's great. Okay, so in the interpretation of Romans 9:5, Tertullian is telling us that Christ is God that is blessed forever. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah.
Okay. And how is that a Unitarian passage in Tertullian? Is he translating that in a perfectly Unitarian type of manner?
Yeah, that's a way that some Unitarians, ancient and modern, take it. He explains his language the way he uses the word God. What he basically says is that when he's talking about the Father alone, he'll reserve the word God only for the Father and reserve the word Lord for the Son. But then when the Father is not in view, then he'll go ahead and call the Son God. He's clear that the term is equivocal. Again, it's clear that he thinks the Father is greater, and he explains what he's doing with his usage of terms. So it's no problem for my position at all that he can call Jesus God. Of course he does. All second century Catholic authors do that, much more than the New Testament does.
Okay, Dr. Tuggy, you just admitted to me that your interpretation of Romans 9:5 would be to interpret God here as God the Father, yet you also admitted to me that Tertullian is referencing God here to be Christ. So you disagree with Tertullian in this sense, yet you say that you can agree with him. How does that work? I don't get it.
I agree with his point that I just discussed. His point is that, and this is in John 10 in the New Testament and elsewhere in the Bible, his point is that beings other than the one true God can be described as God and addressed as God, and this doesn't conflict with monotheism because it's like you have a kingdom, and in addition to calling one guy the leader, sometimes you also call lower down people leader. Well, that doesn't mean it's not a monarchy. There's still really just one unique king, this point of language shouldn't confuse that. And I don't have the reference handy, but he's very explicit about it. I can find the reference in a minute.
That's perfectly fine. We're talking about against praxis here right now, and he is talking about Romans 9:5, and you just admitted that he's talking about Christ here. And the passage is talking about eternal God, God blessed forever. And you admitted he was talking about Christ here, yet you also say that you believe that this is in reference to God the Father. Am I correct? Do you think this is God the Son or God the Father when God is mentioned here in Romans 9:5?
Myself, I think it's the Father, but I know it depends on translation issues, and I'm not prepared to discuss those. I did my prep on Tertullian.
Right. No problem. I just wanted to know your personal opinion. I wanted to see it differ from Tertullian's. Okay, my next question to you is this. Dr. Doug Tuggy, are you aware of any father after Tertullian who explicitly brought up Tertullian as a Unitarian?
No, he kind of drops off the radar. It's not clear to me why he wasn't as widely read as some other people like Origen. Although he clearly influenced some of the later guys, he's not. I think maybe it was his Montanist association that made him a little iffy.
Right. I'll agree with you there. But my question is, considering that St. Jerome, St. Cyprian, Augustine, Athanasius, a number of fathers bring him up, do they ever bring him up as a proto or as a type of Unitarian at all?
I'm not aware of that, but there's quite a vast corpus there, so it wouldn't surprise me either way.
So you're not aware of any patristic father, source, writing, anybody that thought Tertullian was a Unitarian?
Well, look, Unitarian wasn't a category in which they argued back then.
Well, you said he had Unitarian theology.
Boy, I'm not sure I have a lot of questions left. I'm not sure I got answers to some of them. Here's one, though, that we haven't got into. As I look at them, the rules of faith that Tertullian cites, and there are three places for this. There's Against Praxeas, chapter 2, On the Veiling of Virgins, 1, and then Against the Prescriptions of the Heretics. I don't have a chapter number on that, but do you agree that those are rules of faith that a Unitarian can consistently accept?
Well, I wouldn't need an example. I mean, you tossed out a number of references there. I need to pull up at least one. I've got Against Praxeas chapter 2 open. The other ones, you said them too fast to pull them up. Just tell me where you're referencing them, and
sure,
we can get into it.
Yeah, so, well, I have one in front of me. It's the one from Prescriptions Against Heretics, and it's pretty simple. I'll just read it. So Prescriptions Against Heretics 13 says, "We believe there is but one God," that's clearly the Father, "who is none other than the creator of the world, who produced everything from nothing through his word, sent forth before all things," again, temporal creation there. "This word is called his Son, and in the name of God was seen in diverse ways by the patriarchs, and finally was brought down by the Spirit." Do you agree that that's a creed that a Unitarian could agree to?
I think that most creeds, if interpreted in a Unitarian type of theology, as we've already seen throughout this debate, a Unitarian can pretty much agree with anything in the early church if they twist it. Yeah, I do.
Sorry, by twisting it, do you mean to understand the one God as the Father rather than the Trinity? Do you think that's twisting it?
To say that Tertullian believed that the Father was eternal God, the Son was not, the Spirit was not, and that there were not three persons, as we've already seen that he does teach, yeah, I do think that'd be twisting it. I think that if we read him in isolation to his other works, we can pull out a number of things. This is one chapter out of...
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that I'm not reading him in isolation here or cherry-picking passages. I'm looking at the whole picture.
And,
well, when you compare this to all the other passages, we see Tertullian expounding exactly what he believes by the creator of the world, what he believes by eternal, and how he interprets biblical passages to interpreting the Son as eternal. So, yeah, I do think this passage is you're interpreting in isolation to others.
Here's another question. Is part of being fully divine being essentially omniscient?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you agree that Tertullian says that the Son is ignorant of the last day and hour, which is known to the Father only?
I completely agree. He says that, I believe, in against Hermogenes or against Praxeas. I don't exactly recall.
That's in Against Praxeas. It's it's the very end of chapter 26. Well, not the very end, roughly the last paragraph. Well, so then would you concede that even though he thinks the Son is divine because he's made of divine matter, would you concede that he's divine in a lesser sense than the Father?
Tertullian never ever says that because he's divine in only the sense of matter that he's less than the Father. Tertullian, in a number of places, seems to denigrate the Son and to say that the Son was made or created, and in this sense say that the Son is ignorant. A number of passages seem to him to be referring to the human portion of the Son. So in that sense, he's saying that he is ignorant of the last day and hour.
Right.
He says it in another passage as well, where he's differentiating, let me finish my sentence, where he's differentiating between the Son and the Father. He differentiates between the fact that the Father begat the Son and what have you. But again, this him saying that the Son is ignorant of the last day and hour doesn't then, in turn, support Unitarian theology in any way whatsoever.
Well, it supports that the Son is not divine in the same sense as the Father. So here's another question in Against Praxeas, chapter 9.
We're referring to human nature here.
Right, that's what you have to say. So here's my question. In chapter 9, he says, the Father is all being, but the Son is a tributary of the whole, he's referring to the divine matter, and a portion, as he himself declares, because the Father is greater than I, he quotes the Gospel. Tertullian continues, so also the Father is other than the Son, since he is greater than the Son, since it is one that begets another that's begotten. Now, are you aware of anywhere in Tertullian's works where he makes the qua defense, where he says, you know, qua human, he's less great, but qua divine, he's just as great. Are you aware of any passage like that?
I don't quite understand what you're referring to, but I know exactly what you're referring to. Where he speaks of, he says that he's a portion, that the Father is the whole. Is that the passage that you're referring to?
Right. He says he's greater, and he doesn't qualify it relative to a nature. That's a later move that Tertullian just doesn't make.
Yeah, correct. But again, in a number of places, what I was saying just a little while ago, when Tertullian says that the Son is lesser, he's referring to his human nature, explicitly referenced.
He doesn't say that. That's the point.
He does say that.
All right.
Many times. I think today's debate has shown us a great deal about the patristic writer Tertullian. We saw that Tertullian, in his De Anima on the Soul, believes that Almighty God is the only one without sin. Again, we weren't able to go into that earlier, but he mentions that Christ is God. Only God is free from sin, he says. He said Christ is that God. We saw that Tertullian was one to quite often speak his mind. And he did that quite often in affirming the eternal reality of the Son by saying how the Word became flesh. I grilled Dr. Tuggy on that over and over. He agreed that the Word here is indeed Christ. But he seemed to have a sort of disconnect when we read that the Word became flesh, the Word is transfigured, and then it says, for the rest we must need believe God to be unchangeable and incapable of form as being eternal. As being eternal, ut aeternum, as being eternal. Dr. Dale Tunney, who apparently he must be really familiar with Aladdin, he agreed that this passage was talking about the Logos. Well, who is the Logos? The Logos is Christ. Or he said in another passage that this must mean that Christ became eternal at a later point in time, after he was made. But that's not what Tertullian is saying. He says that God is unchangeable. Come on now. If God only became eternal after he was made, if the Logos only became eternal after he was made, how can he be unchangeable? That is ridiculous. It tells us, Tertullian says, God is unchangeable, incapable of form, eternal. Eternal. I said that in my opening statement, that Dr. Dale Tuggy had six prepositions in front of him, six arguments in front of him. The Father was eternal God. Tertullian teaches that. The Son was eternal God. Tertullian teaches that. The Spirit was eternal God. Tertullian teaches that. In God there are three persons. Tertullian teaches that. Each of these possess the divine essence. Tertullian teaches that. And guess what? The fathers after Tertullian admit that he taught that. I asked Dr. Dale Tuggy, what fathers after Tertullian used him? Basically said, hey, he's a Unitarian, or hey, he believed this. He believed Unitarian type theology. None of them did. Oh, well, he must have fallen off the map. You're right. There are a few fathers that seem to not want to use Tertullian, because Tertullian became a heretic. He fell away from the Catholic faith. But guess what? There were a lot of fathers that did use him. Cyprian, Jerome, they called him the master. Augustine, Athanasius, they used him. They used his writings. Why did they not say Tertullian was a Unitarian? Why would they bring Tertullian up when they, specifically, those that are arguing against the Arians? Why bring him up? He's a Unitarian, remember? Why bring him up? Tertullian's usage of substantia was a key telling point. We didn't get into that. But again, Tertullian must have been a really weird Unitarian, thinking that the sun was eternal. Thinking that the sun was eternal. Dr. Dale Tuggy told us earlier, he said that Tertullian said, for there was a time when the sun did not exist. Tertullian doesn't say that. I am beyond thrilled that Dr. Dale Tuggy gets to go last. Because the quotation, for there was a time when the sun did not exist, and a number of other quotations come from this book I'm holding in my hand, written by Alvin Lamson. And guess what? Unitarians love Alvin Lamson, but they don't know that Alvin Lamson misquotes a lot of church fathers. Tertullian does not say that. Guess what I did? I scoured Latin translation after Latin translation, English translation after English translation. In that terminology, Tertullian does not say that. In Dr. Dale Tuggy's presentation, where he says in his podcast that these are not misstatements or slips, I would beg to differ. It seems like these are definitely misstatements and definite slips. Slips you don't find in Tertullian anywhere. Again, you can look at Porcion, his reference to Porcion. We weren't able to get into that very long. But again, if Dr. Dale Tuggy is going to try and say, well, Tertullian said that Christ was only a portion and the Father was whole, it's interesting. Because guess what? The Unitarians that came way before Dr. Dale Tuggy and way before Alvin Lamson, they read that passage of Tertullian where Tertullian says that he was a portion only. He was a portion only. Right? They read that. And did the Arians, did these, I'm not saying that Dr. Dale Tuggy is an Arian, but did these sort of Unitarians, did they interpret this passage in the way Dr. Dale Tuggy did? No, they don't. In a surviving manuscript, they repudiate such terminology. They disagree with the son being a portion of the Father in the way Tertullian's saying it. It seems obvious that whereas Tertullian's calling the son a portio, seems to be in reference to the incarnate son. And in this sense, whereas he calls him a portio, he considers that portion to be eternal in its essence, and he outlines that throughout his writings. Over and over and over, he outlines that. The 6 points remain. The Father, the Son, the Spirit were eternal God. God, there are three persons. Each possess a divine essence. And Tertullian's usage, whereas at times a bit thorny, was consistent. A Unitarian cannot tell you that the Son was eternal. And his description of Romans 9:5, I'm glad Dr. Dale Tuggy admitted that Romans 9:5 in Tertullian was in reference to who? To whom? It was in reference to the Son. It was in reference to the Son. Dr. Dale Tuggy says, well, I think that's in reference to the Father. I'm glad he thinks that. Tertullian didn't think that. He interpreted Romans 9:5 to be referencing God blessed forever. Christus ta kathes arka, referencing God, Ionos, is Christ, God blessed all over. I confess to you that Tertullian was a Trinitarian, and nowhere a Unitarian. And I will now surrender the rest of my time to Dr. Dale Tuggy, and I've appreciated his time today. Thank you.
Okay, again, gentlemen, thank you for having me. I appreciate your show. I appreciate spirited and reasoned debates. I recommend Lamson's book called Church of the First Three Centuries. I think it's very informative. I'm not sure what problems my opponent had with it. Let me review what my opponent's done. He's fastened onto the word eternal, as applied to the Son, and also fastened onto one verse in Paul, which Tertullian reads similarly to later Trinitarians. And he's kind of built his case on that, but he's ignored the wider scope of Tertullian's theology. He's not addressed a lot of important points. Like many others, he fastens onto the term substantia, substance, but I explained in what sense he thinks the three are one substance. They're made of the same stuff, or rather the Father's made of all of it, the Son's made of less of it, and the Spirit's made of yet less of it. He has a strange argument from silence, Why didn't the Arians use Tertullian? I don't know, but, I mean, Arians and all other people in the 3rd and 4th century pretty much disagreed with his materialist theology, where he thinks that a spirit is made of a special, more subtle kind of matter. About the sun being eternal, of course, many famous Unitarians agree that the sun is eternal. Shining example of that is Samuel Clark. He accepts the later post-origin Catholic theory that the Son is mysteriously, timelessly, eternally generated by the Father, but he's Unitarian because he identifies the one God with the Father, as do I. I'm afraid my opponent did not rebut the following points, which I clearly showed from Tertullian, that the Father is older than the Son, that the Father is greater than the Son, that the Father is assumed to be the one God, that he calls the Son God, but yet it's clear that he doesn't think the Son is divine in the same sense that the Father is divine. He's not omniscient, for instance, nor is he eternal. He also did not address my careful explanation of the passages where Tertullian discusses the creation of the Son, where he kind of treats this as God speaking out his internal word, which is eternal. And yet it really is a creation. He's clear about that. He made the word into a son for himself, and it was only at that point that the son was a living self, was an agent capable of action and knowledge and will. Nowhere does Tertullian say that the one God is the Trinity. He does talk about a Trinity. It's a Christian triad. God is the founding member of that triad. God brought about that triad by sharing portions of his matter with other beings. And he's very emphatic, of course, that the Son and Holy Spirit are other beings, because his famous work against Praxeus is directed against monarchians who are confusing the three as one being. Sometimes the position he's arguing against and against Praxeus sounds a lot like Trinitarians. He says we should reject the view, this isn't against Praxeus, that this self-same God is both Father, Son, and Spirit. That sounds like a lot of later Trinitarians, but of course he's refuting the monarchian theology there, which we didn't really get into. So again, back to the definitions. Trinitarian Christian theology says there's one God who in some sense contains or consists of three persons, namely the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and they're equally divine, and this is eternally so. Unitarian says there's one God who's numerically identical to the Father and not to anyone else, and that's eternally so. Tertullian's theory meets the first condition of both definitions. He does strongly insist there is just one true God. However, there are stages in his theology. He's what you would call a two-stage or a three-stage logos theorist, because he thinks that a finite time ago, God took a portion of his matter, and while not losing that matter, and not giving it up, also made that matter to compose the Son, and then he did it again for the Spirit. Just as clearly as Tertullian meets the first condition for both definitions, and for being a Trinitarian, he clearly fails the last two conditions for being a Trinitarian, because his Son and Spirit are not equally divine with the Father, because they're composed by only a portion of his divine matter. Even if they were equally divine with the Father, they did not always exist in his view. Even if they did always exist, which he doesn't say that, and he says the opposite several times, he explicitly says that the Father is greater, and he means that. He doesn't qualify it by saying, well, greater than the Son with respect to the Son's human nature, but not with respect to the Son's divine nature. He doesn't do that. And so it's misreading later dubious argument strategies onto him to attribute that to him, as my opponent, I think, was doing. Does he meet the second criterion for being Trinitarian, that the one God in some sense contains or consists of three persons? Arguably so, because once all this emission, once these prolations are over, then if contains means that the various portions of the divine matter constitute or compose three selves, this is the kernel of truth in the common misreading of Tertullian as a Trinitarian. He does have a vague idea in common with at least some Trinitarians that there's a common stuff or matter or something like that to the three. But of course, that puts him at odds with many other Trinitarians. I already mentioned that the fully developed Catholic theory is committed to divine simplicity. It's in the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215. Of course, someone who believes in a material God and thinks that the matter's been divided up does not believe in an absolutely simple being at all. He also would disagree with those Trinitarians, people like Barth and Rahner, who seem to think that the Trinity essentially is one self and the, quote, persons are really kind of eternal ways that God exists. They're kind of like personalities or something like that, modes of operation. He would be against that because he strongly affirms that there are three persons here. So in contrast with that, he's clearly not a Trinitarian. He clearly is a Unitarian, just as much as people like Isaac Newton, Samuel Clarke, Thomas Emlyn, Noah Worcester, and just as well as other leading pre-Nicene theologians like Origen, Irenaeus, Justin, and Novatian. So it's not true that mainstream or Catholic Christianity has always taught a Trinitarian faith. The second and third century theologians were leading Catholic intellectuals in our day. He did have a sort of break. It's kind of unclear whether he ended in communion with the church, Tertullian, but the basic fact is that he was a leading champion of the Catholic cause for most of his life and was gladly accepted as such. And it's an interesting question how and why, starting in the latter half of the fourth century, this older Unitarian theology began to change into a theology of a tripersonal being. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you online at trinities.org.